Hello and welcome to the Professors In Podcast. Before we begin, let me take a brief moment to recognize our sponsors. And that is you, or someone like you, who has made the decision to support us for $3.99 a month and make it possible for us to pay the person and technology that makes this all happen. So thank you very much for that. If you would like to become a supporting sponsor of the Professors In Podcast, please visit bit.ly/OurPod, O-U-R-P-O-D. That's bit.ly/OurPod, and learn about all of the really cool insider information and access you get by being a member of the podcast.
Yes, indeed. We love our supporters. I am Dr. Karen Kelski of The Professor Is In.
And I'm Kel Weinhold, also of The Professor Is In. And we are excited to have you here for our 52nd podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That's interesting and a little random. Let's celebrate our 52nd podcast.
I just think it's so much better than just saying, now this is our 100th podcast. We're random here at The Professor Is In.
Also disorganized and not keeping track. Or I guess actually one of us is. Anyway, we're delighted to have a guest with us today, Dr. Chris Catterine, who is the author of the new book, Leaving Academia, A Practical Guide. And I talk about this book constantly. I just gave a keynote address at a big conference at Berkeley for grad students leaving the academy, and I talked about it there, and I reviewed it on the blog, and I just think it's a really cool book because not only is it urgently needed because so many people are leaving the academy, but Chris writes with humor and compassion and a down-to-earth tone and real practical advice that I really appreciate. So, Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for those kind words. It's really nice to hear.
Oh, absolutely.
So, one of the things that I know from talking to people this year in particular is that a lot of people are thinking about leaving the academy, whether leaving by no longer trying to get in or really deciding maybe it's not what they want to do. And I know from them that it's really helpful to hear the stories from people who have left. So I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit sort of your beginning, middle, and exit. How did you come into the PhD? What did you think you were going to do? And what happened?
I came into my discipline of classics really young. I took Latin in middle school and high school. I took ancient Greek in high school, and I really thought that classics would be something that set me apart at the high school level and let me go and get a degree in law, actually, ultimately. So it was sort of a trick to get into college, but by the time I actually got there, I realized I'd fallen in love with this discipline and wanted to do it pretty much every free opportunity I had. So I took way more classes than I was supposed to be allowed to in Latin and Greek in college. And when it came time to figure out what to do next, all I wanted to be was a professor of Latin. So I went straight into the PhD, fought through that. I was long distance with my wife at that point. She was at Princeton, I was at UVA, which introduced its own set of challenges. Right. We ended up kind of coming back together, and she got a job in New Orleans at Tulane, where she still is actually in academia, and came down here. And at a certain point, we realized that the two-body problem was in fact a problem, that we probably could not both work permanently in the same place. And even if we did want to start looking for tenure-track jobs, that would be pulling us away from a city that we'd fallen deeply in love with. And we felt more ourselves here than we did at any place else that we'd lived. So because her job is renewable but not tenure track, when we made the decision to stay here, it really meant that she could keep her career and I could not keep mine because I was on a terminal contract. So at that point, I began using what cushion I had in the last 2 years of a visiting assistant professorship to explore outside careers, and had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I was terrified. It wasn't just that I didn't know what I would do. It's that I really did not know who I would be if I wasn't doing Latin. I'd been reading Latin since I was 11 years old. I couldn't really remember a time when I didn't. And so that was terrifying and at times crippling. And I sort of fought through that and made myself meet new people and learn new things and get out there. And in the end, in August of 2017, I began my current job as a proposal writer and communication strategist for a global consulting firm, where I actually work with, I think, four or five other humanities PhDs.
Wow. That's fascinating. I did not expect that last little bit.
That last line, kind of threw me.
I love your story. When I do coaching and speaking about leaving the academy, I spend quite a bit of time talking about the emotional upheaval of it, which you've already alluded to. You said it so beautifully. Who would I be if I were not a classics professor, a classics specialist? So can you talk a little bit? In fact, that's actually what I like about most about your book, is that you're not just like, hip, hip, hooray, you know, you too can take your skills to the non-academic world. It's like, no, there's grief, there's loss.
Yeah.
There's pain and anguish, and you have to work through it if you're actually going to manifest this transition in a healthy, effective way. So can you talk a little bit about that process for you?
Yeah, I began exploring non-academic careers really at the heyday of Quitlet. And there were a whole bunch of pieces coming out. This was around 2015. And, you know, I read the first one. I said, oh, okay, I'm not alone. That feels kind of good. Then I read another one. I said, okay, well, that's more of the same. And by the third, I was sort of bored with it. And there was this backlash that came too, which said, why should I applaud that you've quit a job? That's not a big deal. People do it all the time. And I was sort of struck by this fact that people felt that they did need to make a public declaration. There was something that was satisfying, I think, in making the declaration and seeing other people make it. And yet, I thought the criticism was fair in a way, in as much as it doesn't actually help you do anything. Like, once you see somebody say, all right, I'm leaving, okay, what do you do with that? And so, because I was an academic and because I arrogantly assumed that career advice that wasn't targeted at academics could not apply to me, I sort of felt stuck where I didn't think that there was practical advice for somebody in my position, but I was also sort of dissatisfied with the way that more emotional engagements with leaving the academy embraced the emotional side and then stopped. Mm-hmm. And so I really felt like this was something that there was a gulf between these two, the pragmatic and the emotional. And for me, so much of leaving the academy is that you need to understand those two things together. And so when I set out to write my book, it wasn't that I thought that I necessarily had anything unique to say. The advice that I give is good career changing advice, and that is true for anybody. The emotional anguish of leaving the academy, I think, is going to be true for anybody who's left the academy. But I did think that I saw an opportunity, and I thought that I had anecdotes from my own life and from people that I'd spoken with that helped to show how these two things, the pragmatic and the emotional, really do need to come together for people leaving academia to make this transition successfully and in a healthy way, and in a way that doesn't just leave them in a different sort of dead-end job that's mm-hmm. going to leave them unsatisfied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's just brilliant. Yeah, that's what I loved about it. That's why your book resonated so much with me, because that's what I absolutely do. And I've been at this so long now. You know, Professor Zinn has been around for a decade, and I too watched the heyday of Quitlet and so on. And it's super repetitive. You know, everybody discovers this harsh reality for themselves, and it's like it's new every single year, every single time, even though it's been going back now, you know, there's been versions of it published for 20 years at least.
Yeah.
What is difficult to watch is how many people don't make a clean break. They get stuck in a loop of bitterness and can't just move on. So I think you're absolutely right in terms of your approach, that you have to acknowledge the emotional along with the pragmatic.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I mean, I begin the book after acknowledging that anguish and grief with saying that you really do need to assess what you want out of life. And if your career isn't going to be supporting how you want to live, then the likelihood of being unhappy is really high. And something that I've found more and more as I've spoken with, you know, a wider array of people, and especially since the book came out, people increasingly from the STEM disciplines, in addition to the humanities and social sciences, is the extent to which people didn't actually realize what they were getting into when they committed to an academic career,
right?
Because so much of that is built up in your own imagination of what you see your professors doing from the student's vantage, rather than actually asking them what that job is like. And right. They tend to professors tend to do a good job of hiding the bad parts from students, although that may be changing.
Yeah, for sure.
So could you, this may be a lot to ask, but you brought up the question, and I think is the key question, how did you answer, who am I if I'm not a Latin scholar?
That is a really tough question to answer, because I have found over time that it continues to evolve.
Right. Mm.
And right now, I would say I am a communication strategist. Mm-hmm. And I think that covers the work that I do professionally, doing kind of big IT consulting proposals. It covers the career advice that I give, which is so much about actually repackaging and reframing what you do. It also reflects some of the nonprofit work that I've done, trying to connect small educational nonprofit I support called the Nyanza Classical Community to other groups who might want to use our materials and to donors as well. So much of it is communication. Mm-hmm. But how I got from professor of Latin to that is really tricky. And I don't know that I can really say for sure that there were clear steps in between. For me, when I realized I was going to leave the academy, I began doing as many things as I possibly could. Mm-hmm. I began taking night classes in business. I began volunteering with different nonprofits. I began picking up part-time work at a friend's business. I started a blog. I just started allowing myself, or forcing myself really, to experiment wearing different hats. And I was willing to throw one away as quickly as I put it on if it didn't suit me. And I sort of felt out what was the right way to describe myself. And at first it was a departing academic and an advocate for contingent faculty. And then that evolved, you know, in different ways until I eventually realized that communications was probably the place where I was going to end up. And so probably I would say 3 to 6 months before I actually got a job, I had realized this was the direction, mm-hmm. and I'd begun describing myself more consistently in that way in my public-facing materials. But it was a messy period. There was a time where I didn't have an identity, and I was trying to be lots of different things because I didn't know what would land. And I was probably going through a pretty deep depression at that point because I didn't have an identity.
Right.
And I think my wife would say that I should have been in therapy, but she has said that I should have been in therapy. I shouldn't say she wouldn't, she did. But here I am, a overconfident guy who thinks he knows best.
So I didn't. First of all, I just want to tell you that I'm extremely grateful for that answer. Because I think that we hear a lot of prepackaged advice that says, do this, get your LinkedIn, look at this, do that. And we certainly give that advice mixed in with, it's going to feel like you hit a wall really, really hard and slide down it like a cartoon character. So I'm really grateful that you're just saying it was messy and I didn't know, I just knew this wasn't it and I needed to try out a bunch of stuff. So thank you for that. I'm just going to put in a plug, folks. Follow the therapy, not therapy model. So follow the therapy model. When you hit these hard parts, find a therapist. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, for sure. I find myself saying that more and more often with clients. Do you have a therapist?
Like, I feel like our first introduction to every podcast should be, do you have a therapist? Maybe we should get those therapy apps to sponsor the podcast.
Yeah, we should,
There you go.
Right? Yeah.
So
I have a follow-up. I mean, I'm curious to know what I love about your story just now is that you had a lot of hustle. You basically embraced the hustle. I'm going to do a bunch of things. I too embraced the hustle. I did so many things. Took part-time job at a McNair program. I was running my little jewelry business. I was looking at maybe staffing the craft counter at a local hobby shop because I love crafting so much and jewelry making. I mean, there were many things I was doing back then that I never imagined I would consider, having been a tenured professor and department head. And I think the hustle, I was raised that way and it worked out for me. But so my question is kind of an odd one, but where did you find the gumption to do that? Because I don't think that a lot of necessarily grad school does not train us in that. Mm-hmm.
There are a few answers I can give to this. I think the most honest one is desperation.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I had to do something else. I also knew that I am a risk-averse person, and I knew that I needed to create situations where I would not have a choice except to go out and make something happen.
Mm.
And wow. I'm about to tip the hand in a big way on my privilege here, but I'm just going to own it. And one of the things that I did 1 year before my visiting contract was up is that my wife and I bought a house. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I had 13 months to figure out what was coming next, or we would need to sell the house. Mm-hmm. And I knew that without a big fat mortgage hanging over my head, I might not do the things that I needed to do to actually find a new career that paid me at the level that I needed to get paid to keep it. Now, a visiting assistant professor doesn't make very much, so it wouldn't have actually been that hard to do. But I was in a position, and my wife was in a position that we could afford that down payment. And so I recognize that there's privilege involved in that answer, but I recognize something about myself, which is that I wasn't comfortable putting myself out there. And so I had to do something big to make it happen. And it was absolutely terrifying. I was shaking when I signed that document, physically shaking.
Okay, so sorry to interrupt, but this is really actually pretty cool. For me as a productivity coach, this is really cool because I talk all the time about how academics are self-selecting as a risk averse. Mm-hmm. You want to go into a job where you get in a rut and you stay in it until you die. I'll just do the work you want me to do if you just give me tenure and then I can just keep doing it
and
leave me alone. Because I don't really like, no humans do, but academics really don't like liminal states. I just want to be here. So the fact that you recognize that and then put yourself in a position of being forced into it by scrambling around to get a mortgage right before you lose a job is an absolutely brilliant / wild / oh my God strategy to... But I think it can be, for those listeners who are like, well, I can't buy myself a damn house. There are things that you can do to put yourself at the limit of what you can tolerate. Mm-hmm. So there's this awesome line in stress between stress for motivation and stress for overwhelm. And everybody has to define their own line. But basically what you did is you got on that razor's edge of stress for motivation, which we need. That's why we do stuff. Because we have a stress to get it done without letting it tip into overwhelm where you fell over, soft underbelly up and cried. You just, not to say that you don't do that at moments, but you had to be able to write yourself. So that's really a lesson for everybody listening to take away as you think about leaving the academy. What is the thing that's going to force you out of your comfort zone without tipping you into freezing? And it's a person by person proposition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that other side of it, because that's exactly what it was. It was finding that motivation. And for me, my dad is a financial consultant, so I had also seen him hustling my whole life. So I knew that I had a model for that, and I kind of knew what it might look like if I had to do it, but it wasn't my happy place. It is now, interestingly enough. I actually started out pretty introverted and found out by making myself get out there that I'm not. But yeah, I had to make myself do it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm.
So tell me about, sorry, I keep interrupting you, Karen, go ahead.
Well, I want to hear your question, but I just wanted to say that, my parents grew up in the Depression and I grew up on stories with my dad, basically, kind of the parody of like, well, I started work at 10. Well, I started work at 8. Well, I started work at 6. Well, I was delivering papers at 4.5.
Uphill, both ways in the snow.
Yeah. And I grew up with those stories and I didn't realize the degree to which I had assimilated them until I needed to. And I was like, no, I'm making something happen. And I'm not too proud, really, to do, what I have to do to make sure that I am keeping a roof over my head and my kids and everything else.
I was going to say, one of the stories that I tell in the book shows just how willing I was to find something, anything. And it ties into your comment about hobbies, which is that I was brewing my own beer for a while. I was president of the local homebrew club. And I used that to get an interview as a brand ambassador, which sounded kind of exciting. And then I found out that the job was literally pouring samples of beer in the grocery store. And I'm thinking, oh my God, is this really where I'm at? But the answer was yes, because I had to do something. And so I sat for an interview for that job because had to consider it. And I had enough time left on my contract, enough other options that I didn't accept that job, but I seriously considered it. Mm-hmm. Ready mm-hmm. to go. Mm-hmm.
So I think that this brings me around to an interesting point in the academic job search and the academic identity life of and how many people continue to sort of cling onto the edges of the academy to be associated with it to their own detriment out of hopes of something later. And I've often said, you know, you could make more money working at Target than you can as an adjunct and maybe have healthcare and only have to drive one place. So what you said, because I had to, what was the, so what I'm hearing you say is that your guiding light was the quality or was the life you wanted rather than the identity you wanted. Is that the way to read it?
Yeah. I was turning 30 and I looked at it and I said, you know, I'm married. My wife and I think we want to have kids at a certain point. And something that dawned on me was that I would not be able to provide even a shadow of the life that my parents had provided for me if I continued down the road of making $40,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And the thought of raising a kid and not being able to go on a decent vacation now and again, that really weighed on me. And I said, that just isn't actually what I want. Mm-hmm. I assumed that academia would provide a nice middle-class life, that it would be medium risk, medium reward when right. I started. And I entered grad school in 2007. And, you know, that was probably a mirage even then, but certainly after 2008, it became high risk, low reward. Yeah, just had to get out by the time I realized that that was the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So what advice, if you had to distill, of course, you literally wrote the book.
Read the book would be the advice you would give.
But since you're here with us today, and you've talked to so many people, you've given this so much thought, what's your advice for people who are thinking of leaving the academy?
You cannot figure this out alone. You have been trained to think, especially in the humanities, that if you sit with your thoughts long enough and just think through it in the right ways, you will find an answer. That is a slow and foolish approach to the problem of changing careers and changing identities. What you need to be doing more than anything else is talking to people who are not academics, who have had different life experiences, who do different things professionally, to actually figure out what other jobs look like, because you probably don't know, and to help you sort out how you are going to identify yourself. Because in the course of having to explain what you do, you might find that actually the thing that's most essential about you as an academic is that you're a teacher, and teachers are really good at sales.
Indeed.
So that might be a way to go. Huh. And so you won't find those things out if you just sit in a room by yourself and pencil it out. It's not going to happen. So you need to get out there and talk to people, even if that seems scary, even if it seems unnatural. And even if you think that somehow asking for help in that way is an indication of failure, it isn't. This is not something that you can do by yourself.
That's great.
Well, on that note, you are almost out of time. So that was perfect.
I have so many more questions I want to ask you. What do you think the biggest obstacle is for, you've alluded to this in many different ways already, of course, but if you had to distill it down, what's the biggest obstacle that academics confront when they are thinking about this change of careers?
It really does come down to that idea that you don't know who you will be. And I think that identity crisis is so deep. I've heard it from humanists, from scientists, this idea that somehow you won't be yourself if you stop being associated with your academic discipline. Mm-hmm. That is paralyzing, because most people tend to like who they are. And you probably should like who you are, but the idea that you might become different in the process of changing careers, and newsflash, you will develop different personality traits, you will spend your time in different things, you'll think different ways, use different jargon, you are going to be a different person, but if you stop to think about what kind of a person you want to be before you set down that path to finding out what's next, you can have a greater degree of control over that mm-hmm. and become the person you want to be instead of letting your profession shape who you are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think something else that I've realized more and more the farther away I am from the academy is that I made myself into the type of person that I thought a classicist was supposed to be.
Right.
And only a very small percentage of that was actually me.
Oh, right. Wow.
Right, right, right.
It was all these assumptions about what that meant that I built up around myself and you know, cynical. I'm still sarcastic, but I'm less cynical now. Pedantic, all
pedantic,
of these things
that
actually I just assumed that was part and parcel of my job. And they weren't very appealing attributes. And I'm happy to have jettisoned them. I'm more enjoyable person to be around now.
Well, I think that's really interesting. If we go back to our very first episode talking about the academy being a cult, that mm-hmm. part of a process of a cult is to shape your thinking and shape your identity to mm-hmm. see you as your involvement with that is intrinsic to yourself mm-hmm. instead of a job you do. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. because of that, don't have time to talk about how the job shapes you. And so, you're basically pointing that out really clearly of, yeah, it shapes you. And guess what? When you do something else, you'll jettison some things that you thought were you that are just the weird industry that mm-hmm. shaped you. And right. every industry does, mm-hmm. that this one in particular.
Well, also, I would add the joy that will slowly emerge that you're going to like some of these. You're going to love getting rid of some of those qualities, and you're going to love some of the new qualities that arise mm-hmm. that, and you can't anticipate that because you don't know it until you know it.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Christopher Catterine, author of Leaving Academia, A Practical Guide from Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.